it's on the face of it odd that somebody who would start as Secretary of the Department of Labor would become so important. We don't think of that as one of the key positions. But at this time, labor was very important for the Nixon administration, in particular given the militant labor environment, the large numbers of strikes. It was important to maintain communication with labor leaders. So George Shultz and you were unusually important as secretaries of labor because of the lines of communication the two of you could keep open with labor and the individuals you knew personally.
It's true, but George's success and movement to more visible, I guess you could say, influential cabinet officers reflected as much, well, two things. One, although he was a labor economist, he had come, as you know, from the University of Chicago, and I won't say was converted, but certainly had moved towards a monetarist free market position on that. So he was an eloquent spokesman for that within the administration. Secondly, it was the force of his personality and character, which I saw repeatedly. He was a guy of integrity in an administration that had problems along that line. And he had a great capacity for identifying the essential policy issue. In other words, it'd be all these discursive discussions, do you do this and do you do that, and Shultz would really go to the heart of it. I think it's also significant to note that early on in the Labor Department, he had played on a broader stage. And there was some task force set up to deal with oil imports. I remember there was a fellow who ran it, who was the chief staff director, Phil Areeda, R-A-R-E-E-D-A, who was a professor at the Harvard Law School. And it had to do with, as I said, something related to oil imports. And George was either chairman of the committee or principal person. So early on in the administration, he was more expansive than just playing pinochle with George Meany.
There was a West Coast longshoreman strike early on, and
right.
Shultz advised stay away from it, and the parties will figure it out themselves. And Nixon took Shultz's advice, and it turned out to be right.
Well, that's right. I mean, he was a non-interventionist. We'd all been tutored by a professor and active arbitrator at University of Pennsylvania, George Taylor, who liked to say, if the government hangs out its shingle, it can get all the business it'll handle. So he was not an interventionist in the sense that the government should intervene to force any particular solution, which it often devolved into, although he was certainly in favor of mediation, and he could do these things about thwarting or diverting presidential administration, because Bill Ussery was his assistant secretary for labor management relations, and Bill was a guy who came out of the labor movement, the machinist, and probably was the best mediator of his generation. He's still going. Later became Secretary of Labor in the Ford administration.
Shultz was chairman of the Construction Industry Collective Bargaining Commission. Was that more a way of making sure that the wage demands of the local construction unions were in line with what the national...
Oh, right. You know, it was the construction unions that were sort of
the bad boys of the...
Mary, right. And I forget the exact details on who set it up and whether George was the chairman, if you tell me he was. But the heavy lifting was done by John Dunlop.
Okay.
On that. And John was very much opposed to explicit laughs, and you sort of brought them down over time. So Dunlop, and he, George knew him from academic life, and also they both hung around Cambridge for an extended period of time.
Dunlop was from Harvard, right?
Harvard, so right.
I wouldn't have thought that that would have...
The Secretary of Labor, too.
Okay, I'm glad you told me that, because I just assumed that he, being from Harvard, would have had a guidepost, Johnson sort of...
No, John was very different, you know, in that regard. And, you know, people often thought he was too close to the labor movement, but he did it his way. And incidentally, subsequently resigned from the position of Secretary of Labor when Ford... backed away from his Dunlop's pledge to pass a law relieving unions of common situs picketing limitations. It was a very important thing to the construction unions. That is, if one union struck, it would shut down the whole job because they were organized on a craft basis, the so-called common situs issue.
Right.
And that was determined to be a secondary boycott.
Right.
And Dunlop led the charge to get legal relief through a modification of Taft-Hartley, but Ford backed away from it. He's probably right, but in any case, it gives you some of the color associated with those characters.
What was the politics of the suspension of Davis-Bacon Act? Was it done primarily with the idea of influencing bargaining in construction?
Well, it wasn't so much the bargaining. It was, this was a conveyance belt. Walt Scheele was passed in 1934 or something like that, 32. Everybody knew it was a vehicle to transmit union wages to areas outside union strength by defining the labor market in that context. Classic cases were the wages for construction workers in Washington, D.C. were applied to government construction in Quantico, Virginia. And they put in the same high labor. So that was a hoary issue, been around for years to deal with Davis-Bacon and its twin, Walt Scheele, on that. And they suspended it. From a policy point of view, it was the thing to do. But politically, it had always been intractable because of the strength of the unions. And I guess it still is on the books.
Yeah. It was... put back in after a few months. Was it taken off, was the idea it would be permanent, and then there was just so much political
was
heat?
Was it taken off? Refresh my memory. Was it part of that 71 package?
Early 1970.
Yeah.
It was about the same time that things were heating up with the construction industry collective.
Well, I guess they would have hoped it would have been in permanent, but it had been so deeply entrenched. And remember, at that time, another interesting byplay is Nixon was beset over the Vietnam War, and his big supporters on the war were the construction unions. And he didn't particularly want to anger them. I do not know, or if I did know, I don't remember what the specific politics of it were. But I suspect what I just said was an important contributing factor going against the notion of a permanent change.
This gets a little away from the subject, but I want to ask you about the Philadelphia plan, since it was so controversial at the time. And
it was.
Did not seem, for political reasons, seemed to be sort of a loser. Was that Schultz's?
That was Schultz's,
and he
right.
just thought it was the right thing to do?
Yeah, and he didn't view it as quotas. The operative words were goals and timetables, which were earnestly meant in their narrowly descriptive terms. And the things were highly discriminatory, not just in the notion that if a black would show up, they wouldn't give him a job, but in the way they did business, particularly an entrance into the apprenticeship plan. And the one thing I did on my side when I was assistant secretary was promulgate what we now call affirmative action with respect to apprenticeship programs. I mean, there are a lot of provisions in place were demonstrably aimed at restricting entrance. But that's what those unions have done since their inception.
Mm-hmm.
For example, I always remember in Dallas, in the plumbers union, they gave tests to get in the apprentice plan, and 25% or something like that of the weight was given to social skills, you know. It's really important for a plumber, right?
Yeah.
Those were the things you had to have validated tests. But George pushed the Philadelphia plan and the whole non-discriminatory practices at that time as a matter of good policy and, if you will, personal conscience. And I know there was really strong and vociferous leadership opposition voiced by some of the Republican leaders, particularly Senator Dirksen.
Mm, yes.
Who was then the minority leader.
All right. Let me ask you about incipient support for wage and price controls. You were like Schultz. You had graduated from MIT, but you had been at Chicago since...
Right.
Since...
58.
Right. So that you... And philosophically, you and Schultz were very much alike.
I was to the left of him. I mean, you know, and Schultz, George was friends with Milton and mm-hmm. Stigler and people like that, and
right.
I think went through, you know, an honest intellectual shift.
Mm-hmm.
I did, to obviously... You know, I'm sitting in that cornfield, I'm going to understand corn
mm-hmm.
and get to like it. But I had more of an institutional view of the labor market, and therefore I thought wage and incomes policy, if deftly formulated and administered, could have a significant impact mm-hmm. on deflecting wages, which in fact it did.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you read some of the stuff that Dan Mitchell did, and the book he and I did, and he's done a lot of articles since that time, but it didn't have that impact on prices, obviously, or created a bubble later on. But in any case, you know, but I wasn't instrumental in formulating the policy.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly more sympathetic, and I viewed it could have a constructive impact. George, I think it was clear, although he, you know, would never make public statements, as I recall, because it would show disloyalty to, you know, presidential policy
mm-hmm.
against it. I mean, there were two people who led the charge, really three, that explained it. One was Proxmire. You know, it all seems a little quaint now. What was inflation? 4.5% at that time.
Well, it was 6%.
No, it was lower than that by the time it happened.
Well, but yeah, sure, yeah, by the summer of 71, yes.
It was 71.
Yes.
Proxmire had put this, had held hearings, as I recall, early in the summer, and was going to bring up legislation calling for some sort of wage price controls. And remember, there was a historical record in the Kennedy administration.
Sure.
And Walter Heller. And they wanted to, he was going to reconvene hearings on this in September. And for political reasons, they wanted to, you know, undercut him or steal his thunder. But the two guys who were gung-ho for it, for different kind of reasons, were Arthur Burns, who was very, very influential, and probably the key person was charismatic, you know, very activist, and he was Secretary of the Treasury then. And George was not for it, and McCracken, who was then head of the CEA, wasn't for it.
But McCracken had come around. He was had been pushing since early in the year something called the Abuse of Powers Bill, which would have made economic crimes subject to this tribunal. So he had come around to the view that it was labor unions who were driving inflation. So he was sort of weak support for.
Yeah, I don't think intellectually. I mean, he could speak for himself, and I'm sure you're going to talk to him.
I have, yeah.
But he really don't believe that. But Paul's problem was he was the nicest man in the administration.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, he wasn't a bare knuckles guy, and who could stand up to Arthur and John Conley on that? So maybe he did. Remember, this was sort of the heyday of cost push inflations, with unions being an important conveyance belt for that.
Well, the politics of it was that inflation had eroded the relative position of the labor unions in the late 60s, and they were pushing for wage increases that would restore their positions. But when the recession came, that was putting pressure on businessmen so not to raise prices, so that they were caught, their profit margins were declining, so that the businessmen were saying, hey, we need some government help dealing.
They were all for it.
Yeah, exactly.
All of them. But I went down to the business council in the summer of 71, and Fred Borks was the head of GE, I think he was chairman, and there was some panel on incomes policy. I forget whether it was before or after. No, it was before August 15th.
Yes.
Because they all then went and visited the president, and everybody was getting up and saying, do something for these naughty unions. I remember David Rockefeller said something, and the only one who said, hold your horses, was Schultz. And on that panel was Schultz and Burns. I don't remember who else. But that's right.
Carl Rowan mentions that incident in his book, and he says that after the meeting, Schultz asked you to get stuff together and what controls would look like. Is that right, that he asked?
He asked me. I don't think it had anything to do with the meeting.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what had happened is they had made a decision to do it. And he asked me, and I didn't know what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe a couple of weeks. You have to work out the dates. You know, I wrote this little book in pursuit of price stability, and
right.
It was published by Brookings. I
right.
know whether I lined out all the details. But he just called me, and I was then something called associate director of OMB, in charge of management, and basically gave me the charge of doing research on the administration of wage price controls. And we went into the World Labor Board and the Wage Stabilization Board and things like that. And then I was invited up to Camp David, and I didn't know what it was about. But I was told to pack and go on that August 15th weekend. I guess it was the 13th and 14th.
Yeah.
Sunday night, I think, was the time they announced it, the president. So I didn't know the decision was reached until I got to Camp David.
Mm-hmm. Through June, Schultz prevailed. The primary argument was that, well, these controls, they've been tried again and again, and the unions will challenge them. You'll get a strike, and then you've got to make an unpleasant decision, and they'll break down. So through June, basically, that Schultz carried the day.
Well, I guess he did. I wasn't discussions mm-hmm. that were taking place. Mm-hmm. You know, if that was his argument, he was wrong. There weren't many strikes.
Mm-hmm.
There were a few. There was this crazy guy, appropriately called Luna, who was head of the mm-hmm. railroad trainmen. There was the longshore issue. But they're all, you know, fixed in some instances at the expense of the guidelines themselves. But remember, in part, this was sort of a game of imagery. I mean, the whole staff of the Cost of Living Council was 40, of whom 20 were PR people. And we got the IRS to, quote, enforce it, because that struck fear in the heart of the normal citizen businessman.
Mm-hmm.
But I think he was against it for all the, you know, the free market notions. It would, in the long run, or even in the intermediate period, it wouldn't work, and it would cause distortions and inefficiency, and would lead to the bubble. Herb Stein was part of that group, too, and I don't know whether you've talked to him.
Yes, I have.
On that.
Mm-hmm.
Was very funny.
Yes, yes, that comes.
It was. We sat around thinking of Q&As. I remember in his office at midnight. We said, "What kind of controls will these be?" And he said, "Fair and even-handed." You know, we wrote that down. Okay.
Labor had been opposed to the controls. I mean, it had been opposed to
right.
the Johnson guideposts, but. By summer of 71, Meany was making favorable comments. He was saying that, well, if you're going to get inflation down, it's better to do it with controls as long as they're applied evenly. Is that right? Labor had changed
his position? I recall. I mean, but that was sort of a disingenuous argument. You know, maybe he meant it, but he seldom said just what he meant.
Mm-hmm.
He was against controls. Well, I remember these guys came out of World War II experience. It wasn't an alien thing to them. And, I mean, if he was smart, and this was, so there's an inherent structural defect in the operation of controls, in the sense that whatever it is, 4 million employers were all enforcers.
Yeah.
On the wage side. And who could enforce it on the price side? Was some lonely corporal's god of a bureaucracy. I mean, you expect the consumer to go out, but the rules, even the ones that were simple at the beginning, were sufficiently complicated so that you really didn't receive a hell of a lot of complaints, and a lot of them were just trivialized.
Mm-hmm. And apparently the decision, at least, to start talking seriously about controls within the administration occurred in early July, when the Council and Economic Advisors told Nixon that the economy was not growing fast enough to get 4.5% unemployment by summer 1972. And at the same time, the administration was getting the rapid money growth it wanted. But what was happening, at least initially, was that bond rates were going up. There was a lot of nervousness in financial markets. So there was a feeling that if policy was going to stay expansionary and it was going to impact on output and unemployment, something would have to be done about prices. Apparently, that's when Schultz and Connally and Nixon began talking about controls, but at that point they were talking about early in 1972. But several things.
Well, 72. You mean 70, early 71, right? Controls were put in August 71.
Yeah. So at this point in early July of 71, they were talking about controls, but the idea was that they would be put on in early 72.
Mm-hmm,
but several things kind of pushed up the schedule.
My perception was that Proxmire's play in the Congress was very important.
Hmm.
I mean, that was my perception, and
okay.
I remember that clearly.
Hmm.
That he talked about controls. He held hearings.
Right.
He said he was going to draft legislation, as I recall, for presentation after the summer recess.
Mm-hmm. And
they wanted to undercut him.
And those hearings, I believe they would have been the Joint Economic Committee hearings.
Probably.
They highlighted Burns, and Burns made a strong plea that the administration's economic policies were not working and it needed to go to, he called it an incomes policy, but he had already been sending memos to Nixon arguing that they should think about full-fledged controls.
Well, his view of, he always alleged, and a lot of other people, that, you know, when they talked about incomes policy, it just wasn't wage price controls. It was doing something with the minimum wage and Walsh-Yealy and, you know, other frictions and institutionalized impediments to market mechanisms.
Mm-hmm.
I think that testimony, he had a long list of those things.
Right, but that was always, for him, the solution was to limit the market power of the labor unions by reducing the bargaining power of unions, but then, well, you couldn't do that politically, so the next thing was controls. Do you remember about the role the steel companies played in the decision to go to Camp David? Right before Camp David, at the end of July, the steel unions announced price increases after agreeing to large wage increases.
It was 36% to 39% for 3 years, as I recall. That was the wage increase.
Right, and the speculation at the time was that the steel unions didn't want to take the labor unions on and have a long strike, but they didn't have the pricing power to pass on the wage increases, so that they agreed to the wage increases, advertised the price increases as a way of inviting controls on prices that would in turn push back and control their wage costs. And the Nixon administration was in a box if it told the steel unions, no, stand tough, then it would get strikes, and if it got strikes, it wouldn't get 4.5% unemployment by summer of 72. So going back and looking at it, it looks like that was the initiating factor in terms of kind of when to start talking seriously about controls.
Well, I never remember, that logic being spelled out.
Mm-hmm.
Talking about things that are almost 30 years ago.
Sure.
But there were two, bêtes noires. One were the construction unions, and they had put that construction industry wage stabilization group in place
mm-hmm.
in early 71.
Mm-hmm.
Or in 70, and the other was the steel contract.
Right.
And the steel contract wasn't so much from my vantage point, they couldn't pass through the prices, therefore clip the wages and protect our profit margins and do for us what we can't do for ourselves. But the pattern kept going up. It went from 30% for 3 years to 33 to 36, and this was at the high end. And they saw this as part of this process of whipsawing, which ratcheted up what the pattern was. That was my perception on it,
mm-hmm.
not that it was the precipitating event.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't mean it didn't happen.
Sure.
I was not aware of it.
Mm-hmm. Let me read you what was in Fortune magazine later on, where they're quoting you. It says, it was not until August 4th that Shultz instructed Arnold Weber, then associate director of OMB, to get together a study of wage price controls, telling him it was for use in congressional hearings coming up in the fall.
Right, that's right.
And that may have been the Proxmire hearings.
That's right. That's right. August 4th would make sense.
Yeah. Weber was somewhat surprised when on Tuesday, August 10th, Shultz asked him to produce a summary of his findings by the next day. His surprise turned to astonishment when Shultz, after hearing his report, said, okay, go ahead and deal with the operational problems by Friday morning. Weber and his aide, William Kohlberg, had been working on a general review of various control mechanisms.
Mm-hmm.
They had not focused on a freeze except to recommend it as a desirable prelude.
Mm-hmm.
The Council of Economic Advisors had concluded a similar study that same week. So you were working on sort of general review of wage and price control.
Which was done. That's my recollection of my instructions.
So very quickly.
About what was to be done and look at it in terms of its operational significance.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that they asked me to get the operational aspects was a surprise, but largely in terms of the compressed time that I was given to do it. Because there was no intimation at the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
That this was a hurry-up exercise in the sense that passage indicated.
When you went to Camp David, at that point, did you realize what was going to happen, or was it
still? Not until I got there.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
When you got there, did you feel that all the major decisions had been made in advance between Shultz and Connally and Nixon, and that they were just primarily, I don't know, trying to bring Burns on board and then tell the rest of the staff members what it...
I wasn't at that level, but everything wasn't buttoned up.
Mm-hmm.
It was the question of coverage, the nature of the freeze, and as I recall, and Herb could tell you, they really decided probably the most decisive thing was to close the gold window. Was that was decided up there. I wasn't privy to those discussions.
Which part of the discussions were you in on at Camp David?
I was, the ones where we talked about, the big issue. I remember going in with the president is whether we'd cover agricultural commodities. It was sort of subsequent to the decision to have the controls. I was not part of that discussion. I was, a second-level guy at that point. But really the mechanics and coverage, which were not unimportant,
mm-hmm.
for example, to exempt agricultural commodities. And then there are subsequent other issues, the commodities and futures market, the stock market, things like that. And I was involved in the drafting of the initial executive order. As a matter of fact, somewhere in my files, I think I still have a copy of it with my notations on it, and Arthur Burns, as I recall. And Bill Sapphire at that time got in on it. He was the
speechwriter.
The speechwriter. And that's a funny thing. He insisted that it be called the Cost of Living Council. It was originally the Council on Wage and Price Stability. Doesn't mean anything, but so that's where I got in on it.
Mm-hmm.
The duration, that was another discussion, whether how long it was going to be.
Shultz assumed that it would be a relatively short program and would be over quickly, or was there sort of really no...
I think everybody did. Everybody assumed that it would be over quickly. And remember, the notion and the theory was, one, deal with unions, along the way you an institutionalized power, along the way you described it. And the other thing was to deliver a sharp blow to what was called inflationary expectations.
Mm-hmm.
So that was part of the theory of the case, which I remember all the time, which is sort of a deus ex machina.
Mm-hmm.
But that was the other one of the explanations that were floating around at the time.
Mm-hmm. Were you privy to any of the international or trade discussions, textile quotas with Japan, that kind of thing?
That I recall, no.
Mm-hmm. Did you and Herb Stein do most of the sort of nitty-gritty work of designing?
Did a lot of it, yeah. And there was a guy, I've got a picture, somebody from the Treasury Department. He was Associate General Counsel or something.
Mm-hmm.
I've got a class picture of one of my prized ones with Ehrlichman and Haldeman and Paul Volcker and Schultz and Ken Dam.
right at the law school. I haven't right. talked to him yet, but I will. My son.
He might, because he was up there on the international stuff. He had come into the administration recently, I think, to head the, or be the principal staff guy or the deputy director of the Center of the Council for International something or other. I'm not sure Pete Peterson didn't run that. I think Peter was there, too.
Was Flanagan involved at all in that sort of
thing? I don't remember. Flanagan was always around.
Yeah.
But I don't remember whether he was up there. Mm. Not sure that he was. Do you, you can jog my memory on it. Was he?
I don't think he was at Camp David.
Oh, I don't think he was at Camp David.
In terms of discussing...
Flanagan was ubiquitous.
And he could sort of... I mean, I just basically know about him from Fed recollections that he could... was viewed as somebody who could get things done and kind of...
Well, he had the president's ear.
Yeah.
And he was a guy of great self-confidence.
Mm-hmm.
And after Camp David, we started having meetings at a council, of course, the Living Council. He used to come as a White House representative. It was one very amusing thing off the record with...
Did C. Jackson Grayson get involved at this point?
No, he wasn't there at all.
He wasn't there. What about...
Came in afterwards.
What about Charlie Walker from the Treasury? Was he involved in the setting up the control programs?
Not that I know of. Certainly not the mechanics. Unless, where Charlie was, Jesus, you have to cross-check all of these things.
Oh, sure, sure.
They're all getting old. But what happened... is you have the Cost of Living Council, which was the cabinet-level council, agriculture and labor and commerce, and Arthur used to come regularly, and we'd meet every day or every other day. But then there were the four wise men that would meet before, hash over the issues, and make the preliminary recommendations, and that was me and Charlie Walker. I don't remember the other people. Mm-hmm. But there was a group, but that was, the actual sort of running process of policy formulation as issues came up.
So Arthur Burns actually came to these meetings.
Oh, yeah. He came regularly.
Hmm. Like, the story was he only slept 4 hours a night, so he had time to...
Well, whatever it was, he was there and was very vocal, and, most of the cabinet officers came. I remember this was a big thing and an exciting thing, and if for no other reason, they were there to participate and to protect their own pea patch. Virginia Nauer, she was there.
Burns regularly lobbied for a low inflation target and corresponding low pay guideline, 5.5% for originally. I mean, and that was, he was... always pushing for kind of getting the wage guideline down.
Right. Of course, in a way, he succeeded, but as you got into the actual administration, I came to appreciate that you have a choice between a relatively high or generous guideline and few exceptions, or a relatively low demanding guideline, demanding in terms of the environment, and a lot of exceptions. Now, in phase one, we didn't have any exceptions. I mean, a few, but very little, because the notion was that anybody could stand anything for 90 days.
Yeah.
And equity demanded that what happened to you was determined by just randomness, where you were on August 15th.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you're talking about phase two.
Yeah.
And that was a different, evolution.
Mm-hmm. Why was labor so virulent in its attack on you and the other members of the other administration members of the pay board, Kermit?
Oh, we were just a fire hydrant, that's all.
So
and George Meany would call me a son of a bitch, and the like, and come over and put his arm around me and say, I didn't mean anything personal. Mm-hmm. In my case, there was another little twist, because my father was an activist in a construction union in New York, which is where George came from, where Meany came from. And he was a construction electrician of the same generation of Meany. I don't think they knew each other. Hmm. They certainly knew the business agent.
Hmm.
The business agent of my father's union, a guy by the name of Harry Van Arsdale, who was legendary.
Oh, yes.
In his day.
Yes, I remember that name.
Being, you know, both progressive and benignly autocratic. I mean, funny little thing that I often said is my dad by that time was retired down in Florida, where good union electricians from New York went to retire those days. And he went to the AFL-CIO convention in December of 71, you know, for old time's sake, and heard Meany attack his good-hearted youngest son by calling me Connolly's running dog.
I think he called you a hatchet man, too.
Yeah, oh, yeah, but I was just, you know, Meany was a guy where vituperation was sort of his stand-up idiom, and that's what people do in collective bargaining those days.
But that the meeting you talked about, that was the one where Nixon came. And
he in 71?
Yeah. And
I guess he did.
And Nixon took
he really
felt that he was treated rudely.
The guy who was really treated in a demeaning way was Jim Hodgson, who was Secretary of Labor, had been Undersecretary and replaced George Shultz. And I remember after we, you know, announced controls, we went over to the Labor Temple on 14th Street there, or 16th
yeah.
Street, I guess. And we went up to the boardroom, and I sat at the table, and somebody else, he made Hodgson sitting back. I mean, he wouldn't let him at the table. No, I didn't sit at the table, but that's all right. You know, I was the second guy, but the Secretary of Labor, he wouldn't let him sit. And all of those guys sort of went around the table saying this was the end of the Judeo-Christian morality, economic justice, and everything else in rather spicy language.
But Labor stayed on initially because basically they got most of what they wanted. There were no, initially, there were lots of contentious issues, but there were no, Labor didn't lose any big battles.
Well, what they viewed, I mean, the longshoremen, I forget it was before or after the walkout.
It was the longshoremen.
I mean, the longshoremen.
That's what triggered the walkout in the spring of 72.
And then either before or after were the railroad trainmen. But remember, this was a tripartite board then.
Mm-hmm.
Employers, as was usual, helped mm-hmm. create the environment and pressure for it. But once they got into the situation, they were looking at their own self-interest, and they often were accommodators and wanted to be flexible, and it was the public members, Kermit mm. Gordon, Bill Caples, Neil Jacoby, me, and the hapless Judge Bolt.
Oh, yes.
Stood for things there, particularly Kermit, who was wonderful. But I remember somebody associated with the railroad industry, and when we were going to cut their wages, you know, the settlement down to, I think it was the 7%, you know, it was the so-called last cows in the barn, as I recall. This guy came into my office and told me I was going to ruin his industry. I mean, in language that would elicit the envy of George Meany.
This was the employee.
Employer.
Hmm.
You know, in other words, we might create a situation where there was a strike.
Hmm. Did Labor walk off in the spring primarily because Meany didn't want to support the administration in an election year? Was that the primary
reason? That was probably it. You know, they, as you indicated, they had been there. We had set the rules. They had argued for them and got some accommodations that might be expected. I don't know, but they just sort of announced one day that they were walking off. And I'm sure that it was in a significant measure political. And they didn't want to be, class collaborators with what they considered an iniquitous system.
Mm-hmm. Well, it did eliminate the role of the labor unions in negotiating wage increases, so it was, they must have stayed with it as long as they did because of popular support and not wanting
to. But it was phased well into phase two.
Right.
That they stopped, and remember all the issues about how you figured the what was the guidelines? It was
the pay guideline?
5.5. And how you figured it, there were these alternate methodologies, whether you took a snapshot or you looked
right.
at it, and whether you counted roll-up, which was the cost of benefits, and what was
right.
the base.
Right.
There were all of these things. So now it was in the sense of routine, more routine applications.
What were the debates over in moving to phase three at the beginning of 73?
I was out of it by then. But I can't contribute to that.
Okay, then let me go back. In 71, before Camp David, were you an advisor to President Nixon, or were you just on the OMB?
No, I was on OMB staff. I was not an advisor in the sense that term is used. If I was, it was through Shultz.
Mm-hmm.
And to the extent that, I got on that platform at Camp David, and I remember making a presentation to the cabinet once. Pretty heady stuff for a kid.
Too much of a shock than just to abandon the program when it appeared to be working so well. Well, when did you leave the administration?
The end of phase two.
So you left at the end of 1972.
Right, whenever that was. Wasn't it March 73 by the time before they put in phase three?
I think phase three came, I think Nixon announced it in his inaugural address, which would have been early January.
Yeah, and then there was a month or so just cleaning up. Mm-hmm. But I left at the end.
So you didn't, you went back to Chicago.
I had been back at Chicago.
Mm-hmm. And you didn't?
Really, I left the government full time. Right after the wage price freeze.
Mm-hmm.
I went back to the University of Chicago, and the pay board was nominally part-time. I was then on a per diem compensation and had a different appointment.
I see. So you weren't involved in the internal debates that went on at that point. Let me ask you about passage of the Economic Stabilization Act in December of 1971. At that point, or any time that you were aware of, did you feel that Congress came close to extending the controls to profits and dividends and interest rates
Not from my angle of perception.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't. I mean, there was talk about dividends, but for whatever reason, it wasn't serious. At least I don't remember it as being serious. It might have been at another level. I mean, throughout the freeze, I was pretty well tapped in. Because a lot of these issues were discussed at the meetings of the Full Cost of Living Council. And as I recall, there was some discussion of dividends, but it never got serious. It might have, you know, this was old Rashomon, who saw the reality. Remember the Japanese movie?
Yeah.
About the 19 versions of the same events.
All right.
But we never did any planning.
So your timing was just impeccable as when to leave. The problems with the program really began in 73 when...
I'll tell you whose timing was better, Don Rumsfeld, who you might talk to. He's in Chicago, too.
What,
Don replaced me as head of the Cost of Living Council.
Where is he now, do you know?
In Chicago.
Okay. You don't know what
let me see
organization.
Here. In the interest of scholarship, I have an address book. You know, he's sort of doing what these guys do, investing. As a matter of fact, he's in Washington today. He's on some CIA committee, presidential committee. Let me see. Here we are. You're in luck.
Great. Well,
we set price limits on it. I remember leather pelts, or whatever the intermediate product is, and they all disappeared from the market. Went overseas, you know, they were Argentinian or something like that. But pretty much, if you looked at steel and rubber, and there were a few cases, I remember when Henry Ford, you know, was sort of funny. If you looked at the authority for the Economic Stabilization Act, it was like 450 words in one section of the Defense Production Act, and it gave us more power than the Duma, you know, the Russian Tsar had, for Christ's sake, in terms of setting all these things. And you probably did it. You know, what happened with the controls is, I mean, certainly they were innocent and mischievous at best. But one of the problems is they lasted too long. You know, and nobody had a walk-away strategy, which at the least could have mitigated that bubble, which
yeah.
came on in 74.
Yeah. Yeah. The other thing that I remember was that, which we don't think about now, but in 1970, the combination of 6% unemployment and, at that point, 6% uninflation, the whole economics profession was in disarray.
Yeah.
They hadn't seen that.
Capitalism was crumbling.
And the economics profession ultimately went in two very different directions, but at that point, mainstream economics went in the route of inertia in the price system and contracting and all kinds of institutional factors, and it turned out to be a dead end, but at that point it was kind of what mainstream economics was, and then a very small group went the route of credibility and...
Yeah, who were they?
Rational.
I mean...
Not very many, just a few...
Mainstream guys were Heller, who was continued to live off his past glory with the Kennedy, Bart Okun, you know, very smart guys, Charlie Schultz. A lot of them, that Brookings crowd, joined by Arthur Burns. And at that time, the Friedman, Stigler, et al. Were sort of viewed like primitive Christians, you know, some sort of cranks espousing extreme and unrealistic proposals and policy. So the mainstream, you're exactly right, and remember they had wage policy. Incomes policy in England and France, they were pretty general.
Hmm.
Canada.
Yeah. Do you think the main reason George Shultz stayed through this whole period was that he thought that he could, you know, get, by being there, that he could get the controls off, that people like Schultenstein needed to stay, or they might become permanent, a bureaucracy might develop. I mean, there was considerable support within the administration up to the very end for maintaining a controls bureaucracy across the
that.
Council.
You know, he was also smart enough and broad enough to seeing a whole set of other, in the long run, more profound developments taking place with the end of Bretton Woods, you know, the reduction of tariffs,
yeah,
and things like that, which were really powerful. I've often said I'm probably wrong, but if you look at what's happened now, you sort of trace it back to 71 and going off the gold standards and going to a floating exchange rate, which was a major step towards establishing international market discipline and what policies are.
Yeah, well, if you look at the figure on the percentage of world trade that's formed of by American exports,
right,
it's pretty, it declines, but it's pretty steady through 65, and then the dollar becomes overvalued, and then there's a precipitous decline at the end of the 60s, so that what we what we think about is just sort of living with day to day the kind of economic uncertainties that come with having worldwide competition. That's really when it hit. That's really when it hit home in the early 70s, and the political system had to deal with the demand for individual security, and that reflected itself in government commitment to a low unemployment rate, and the government was asked to do things that it simply couldn't do, and it was asked to do things on a timetable that was not just not of this world. End the war,
and inflation taking place that we didn't know, and that was that step function decline in productivity. The reason it was 5.5 is, you know, we thought there was 2.5% productivity. The guidelines in Kennedy were 3%. In fact, towards the end of the 60s, it was dropping down to 1%, and it stayed there for more than 20 years. That was another thing.
Yeah, well, it was an extraordinary period, and I really appreciate you sharing your reminiscences with me.
You bet.
So thanks a lot.
Good luck.
Goodbye.
Thank you.